Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Hope you had a good weekend. Very tough one for people in the Ridgecrest area. We're going to talk about the aftermath of the earthquakes that struck last Thursday and, of course, the one Friday night as well. That's later this hour. Also coming up in our second hour, the NBA. The focus shifts to Los Angeles. The Clippers with the huge free agent signing of Kawhi Leonard, fresh off his leading the Toronto Raptors to the NBA title. Paul George, a former Angelino who grew up here, joins Leonard with the Clippers and the Lakers, of course, with their stars. So we'll talk about what the NBA future holds. That's next hour. But we begin with the very latest in political news. President Trump saying last Friday he's considering an executive order to put a citizenship question on the upcoming U.S. Census. Also, the Department of Justice announcing that it is going to be swapping out the attorneys who represent the administration in the case before the federal courts. With us to talk about that and other big political stories, Amanda Renteria, the president of Emerge America, a national organization that identifies and trains Democratic women for political office. She also directed Hillary Clinton's political campaign in 2016 and has been a staffer for U.S. Senators Dianne Feinstein and Debbie Stabenow. Amanda, good to have you with us again. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, also with us. He's a research fellow at Hoover, and he advised both the Marco Rubio and Romney Ryan campaigns previously. Lonnie, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Let's start with the president seeking the executive order. Lonnie, let me start with you on this. He hasn't done it yet. He's talked about doing it. What do you think the odds are, though, that this would make its way through the courts?
Well, the odds are very high it would go to judicial review, because the key question in any executive order is what the statutory basis is. You've got to have a law on the books that you're basing executive action on, particularly an executive order, which is the most sacred, if you will, of executive actions, requires a justification that's linked to some law. And with respect to this particular situation, the census is one of those things, the administration of which traditionally has been left to Congress to oversee. The executive actually hasn't had a ton of leeway or leniency given to it in how it's actually carried out. So the question will be, what is the basis on which the Trump administration plans to seek executive action or an executive order? And if they do that, obviously people who oppose that executive order will challenge it in the courts, and it will go back through the judicial system again, and will consider whether the Trump administration's action was lawful with respect to using executive authority to do this sort of thing.
And where does the Supreme Court and its decision of a week and a half ago factor into this?
Well, the Supreme Court did leave open the possibility that there could be some justification for utilizing discretion to put in place a question that would look at citizenship status. I think the question is whether a justification exists, whether the administration is able to come up with that justification or not. So, you know, a lot of this is really getting down to interpreting a number of different things, including, as I said earlier, how much discretion the executive really has in this matter. So it will go back through the courts. There's no question about that. And it continues to be an issue that doesn't just have legal ramifications. Obviously, there are serious political ramifications, which is why we're talking about it. The question of how the census counts and whom it counts goes fundamentally to issues of how much money goes to various congressional districts, and indeed who is counted within certain congressional districts. And that goes to the question of who has political control of the Congress and of state legislatures.
Amanda Renteria, your thoughts on the prospects of such an executive order if the president issues it?
Well, listen, this is, once again, the president using whatever kind of form or power he has to push the envelope and make sure that this is a discussion for his political benefit. And I think as we look at this and as we look at every other action that he does going forward, there's no doubt he is impulsive, and we've seen that, but there's also no doubt that he pushes the legality of anything possible. And as the election cycle starts to heat up, everyone should expect that we're going to continue to figure out where those lines are. And he will push it to the very end using the power of the presidency now. So this is going to be an ongoing debate, whether it's about the census or whether it's about any other legal executive orders he wants to put in. I think we're going to see more of this, not less. And we should get ready for it, both the courts, Congress, as well as the public who listens to what's happening on a daily basis.
The next night tonight, back-to-back debates with Democratic presidential candidates are the last week in July. The Democratic National Committee is making with each round of the debates more rigorous standards for the candidates to be able to qualify. That means they have to show that they have more support in various polls. They have to show that they're gaining fundraising strength as well. Amanda, I wanted to talk with you about that process, because do you think between now and the announcement of the candidates that qualify late this month, we're going to have some folks dropping out?
Absolutely. And in fact, there's already rumors today of Congressman Eric Swalwell thinking about doing that today. But you're also going to see some folks aren't going to hit that 130,000 threshold. And what do they do at this point? Particularly because, as you can tell, if you're not meeting those thresholds or if you're not making news, the campaign ends up moving away from you and the discussion ends up moving away from you. And I think, you know, the first person that drops out will have everyone question whether and why they're staying in. And so I think between now and the next debate, we'll see a couple folks step out or indicate that this will be their last debate if something doesn't change.
And are you seeing already the money backing Democratic candidates start to winnow itself out and coalesce around certain candidates? Or is it still as widely dispersed as it's been?
It's still pretty widely dispersed, but there's no doubt that you're seeing a change from that first debate where money went, whether people thought Senator Harris did really well or a backing off a little bit of Senator Biden. You see what happened. The biggest change really is what happened to Secretary Julian Castro, who today has said made that 130,000 threshold, but it was really based on what happened in the last debate. And so we're going to see more and more what happens from these debates and whether folks rise and fall. But at some point, you're just not making the cut. And that's certainly what every single campaign is going to go through. And you're going to, like I said, I think this is going to be the first announcement that comes out. But I think we'll see a couple of more before we get to the next debate.
Lonnie, how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the summer before the primaries begin is obviously a very interesting period. If you look back to 2016, 2012, you know, there were some notable people who were in the race and made the decision not to continue for a variety of different reasons. I mean, oftentimes these folks might even be candidates who are considered very much viable. I mean, you think back to a guy like Tim Pawlenty, who was the governor of Minnesota and ran against Mitt Romney in 2012 and ended up dropping out toward the end of the summer because he couldn't get traction. The fundraising dried up. And for all sorts of different reasons, you're going to have different candidates seriously evaluating, particularly when the field is this big and particularly when you've got debates every month. And as we saw from the last debate, already you see that there are a separation between various candidates. And I think that certainly results in people reevaluating. So I absolutely expect a lot of turmoil in the field going between now and certainly the end of the summer as we cross that Labor Day mark when people really, really begin to tune in.
At the previous second night's debate between the candidates, there was an intense back and forth between Senator Kamala Harris and former VP Joe Biden over a couple of issues. One of them involved mandatory desegregation through court-ordered busing, and Senator Harris went after Joe Biden over his opposition to court-ordered busing. He also had previously touted his ability to work with people with whom he had stark disagreement. He mentioned working with a pair of senators who were segregationists and that Biden was even willing to work with them later in their careers. He had said he wasn't going to apologize for having worked with those two senators, but on Saturday, this is what he said.
Was I wrong a few weeks ago to somehow give the impression to people that I was praising those men who I successfully opposed time and again? Well, yes, I was. I regret it. And I'm sorry for any of the pain or misconception they may have caused anybody.
Now, I don't recall Biden saying anything of praise about the two senators. His point was that even with people that he would have the most extreme disagreement, that he was still willing to work with them. So, Lonnie Chan, it's unclear to me with this apology. Is he just saying he didn't make that clear, that he strongly disagreed with the former segregationists? Or was it that was he apologizing that he had worked with segregationists? I'm still a little confused.
Yeah, Larry, I think your confusion is warranted. But look, I think one of the things that this signals was a shift in strategy from Biden and the Biden campaign. I mean, they obviously felt that they were at an unsustainable position. And whatever it was, he was going to get out there and issue some kind of blanket apology, such as the one he did, in an effort to put this issue behind them. Because whatever they were doing before certainly wasn't working. Whatever strategy was before, he was hemorrhaging at least support in the media. You know, obviously, the question of whether he was actually hemorrhaging real support, no one knows until voters actually go to cast their votes. But it was a marked shift in strategy. And I think in that sense, it's very important to see this as the Biden campaign recognizing in some ways that they have to step up and they have to conduct a different kind of campaign, because the campaign they were conducting, the campaign that Joe Biden was conducting going into that first debate and through that first debate, would not have been a sustainable one to get him to the nomination, in my opinion.
So, Amanda, does he need to go further in your view and say, I should have never worked with members of the Senate who had been segregationists in the past? Does he need to clarify, or does this move this out of the headlines?
I think people are going to continue to talk about this, but I think he's done all he can with this particular conversation. What I do think the campaign needs to do going forward is they just have to move faster. They have to be able to respond crisply, decisively when these moments arise, because what happened here, and I think every candidate goes through this, particularly if you've been in politics for a while, which is how do you describe the accomplishments you've had in the past with the world that is changing so quickly going forward? And remember, every election is about the future. And so being able to position your accomplishments in something you did, but being able to tie that to a future vision is going to be incredibly important. It has to happen in real time and quickly. And this one took a little longer than it probably should have.
Senator Kamala Harris responded saying he is right, meaning Joe Biden, to recognize the impact of his words. Excuse me. And I applaud him for doing that. This was during a press gaggle with reporters in Hartsville, South Carolina. She said there is still a point of disagreement between he and I, and that remains, which is the issue of busing. We cannot rewrite history about what segregationists were doing at that time on a number of issues, including opposing busing. Now, what's interesting is that Senator Harris has come out and clarified her remarks since the last debate and said that she doesn't necessarily favor court-ordered busing. She herself attributes voluntary busing in Berkeley as being a big advantage to her growing up and exposing her to all kinds of things as a student she wouldn't otherwise have had access to when she was growing up in the Bay Area. But anyway, Vice President, former VP Joe Biden spoke at length with CNN's Chris Cuomo several days ago about his performance in the debate and how he handled the criticism from Senator Harris.
What I didn't want to do is get in that scrum. Do you think the American public looked at that debate, take me out of it, and thought, boy, I really like the way that's being conducted. They're really showing themselves to do really well. Come on, man.
But they're going to come after you.
Sure, they're going to come after
you. Were you prepared for them to come after you?
I was prepared for them to come after me, but I wasn't prepared for the person coming at me the way she came at. She knew Bo. She knows me.
One of the things that we've heard from our GOP analyst who joins us regularly, Sean Walsh, he'd spoken with, you know, some of the people on the Biden staff, and they had wanted him to do rehearsals, debate prep and all. And he apparently had some reluctance to do all of that. Lonnie Chan, your thoughts about Biden expressing his surprise that he was confronted in such a way?
Yeah, well, he shouldn't have been surprised at all. I mean, the reality is that when you come into that debate stage, when you get onto that debate stage in that first debate as the putative front runner, or at least when the polls suggest you're the front runner, you know you're going to take some incoming. And I think the question was whether, in fact, he sort of thought, look, I'm going to take the incoming, but I know how to deal with it. Or whether, you know, he wasn't properly prepared by his staff. For whatever reason, it was pretty clear that that debate performance probably wasn't one that they care to repeat. In some ways, though, what happened almost doesn't matter now, given that there's another debate just a few weeks away, and the news cycle changes with such rapidity that I just have a tough time seeing that sticking unless he has another moment like the one he had in the first debate. Then it becomes a trend and it becomes a problem. But clearly something went wrong there, whether in the prep or whether, you know, sometimes candidates don't want to prep and they don't want to do the things that their staff tells them. And that's okay. They're the candidate. They're entitled to do that. But usually experience demonstrates kind of what the best way forward is. So for the Biden campaign, I would presume they believe that some kind of change in strategy or some kind of change, certainly in tone, is necessary going into the second debate in a few weeks.
JSK writes on our AirTalk page, kpcc.org, seems to me Senator Harris adopted the position of Joe Biden after criticizing him for it. Yeah, it kind of seemed that way to me, JSK. But then she said today that they still disagree on busing. So it's yet another issue that I'm confused on. Amanda Renteria, can you clear that up?
I can't, to be honest. It seems very nuanced to me. What I think is going on here is Senator Harris would like to continue this conversation. I think as you continue this conversation, her pointing out really Biden's inability to respond directly to her in a way that I think the public saw as appropriate, she'd like to continue that conversation. But from a policy perspective, it doesn't seem that they're quite different here. It was much more about approach and the personal response that she had. And really, Biden didn't address that personal response. And so I think it will be very interesting to see whether or not this continues as a policy conversation going forward or as a broader conversation about the impact on in people of color in the education field or something along those broader lines.
And it's so odd, isn't it? 50 years after these decisions came down and, you know, busing hasn't been a front and center political issue in decades. And here this becomes a focal point of the last Democratic candidates debate. Well, we'll continue our conversation with Amanda Renteria, the president of Emerge America, and Lonnie Chen, Hoover Institution at Stanford Research Fellow. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd interviewed Nancy Pelosi and asked the House Speaker about opposition to a border funding bill that came from four relatively new members of the House, Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. And the response that Pelosi is quoted by Dowd as saying is all these people have their public whatever in their Twitter world, but they didn't have any following. They're four people, and that's how many votes they got. Ocasio-Cortez answered on Twitter by saying that public, quote, whatever is called public sentiment, and wielding the power to shift it is how we actually achieve meaningful change in this country. Congresswoman Tlaib said, why would we fund a broken system that rips children away from their parents, deny asylum seekers due process, and fuels a racist ideology that dehumanizes people? She also said it would be better if the House Speaker focused on Mitch McConnell, her counterpart in the Senate, as opposed to members of her own party. Amanda, what do you think of this? And were the comments by the House Speaker very, you know, clearly intended to be a shot across the bow of the four, sometimes referred to as the squad?
You know, as I read her comments, what I read is someone trying to pass legislation. And having spent so much time on the Hill as a chief of staff, That just responsibility to do something about it, to act and to make sure something passes, is really where I took her comments to come from. While the comments of the four women, you know, what they seem to be doing is trying to change the consciousness of the party as well as this country. And that takes time. And that means you're also always pushing where we are today. And I think the real challenge for the Democratic Party and Speaker Pelosi is, how do you bridge that over the next, you know, 6 months, over the next year, while we're going through a presidential campaign?
Lonnie Chen, what do you think?
Yeah, it's. I agree absolutely. I think it's difficult for Speaker Pelosi to figure out what the right way is to bring together disparate parts of her party, and this is a challenge that party leaders have. Oftentimes, the Democrats are experiencing it in the context of their presidential primary. The Republicans will experience it when President Trump leaves office, I think. But it is, I think, for Speaker Pelosi, a huge challenge, and one that she's handled pretty well, if you ask me. I mean, I think she's had a very, very strident group of people in her caucus who have wanted to move things in a different direction, and she has seen her responsibility as getting things done, doing the best she can to do what needs to be done to keep the functioning of government as high as it can be in this era of intense political division. And you know, she's got a very, very, as I said, strident and active group of people who want to move things in a different direction. So she's done well.
Is there a precedent for this among Republicans where you had a longtime either House Speaker or Majority Leader in the Senate and, for lack of a better term, rabble-rousing group of newcomers who've, you know, put the head of the House or Senate into a difficult spot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you see this continuously. You know, you saw it with John Boehner and the Tea Party, and which, you know, eventually became the Freedom Caucus. You saw it with Paul Ryan and the Freedom Caucus. Now, obviously, both Boehner and Ryan did not serve in those roles as for as long a period of time as Pelosi has. But, you know, they were in the Congress for a long period of time. They were well-known entities amongst Republicans. And that split that you saw within the Republican conference on the House side, certainly throughout the 2010s and the 2000s, reflected a split within the Republican Party about what kind of party it should be, how they should work with or not work with an incumbent president of a different party. So it's not certainly something that's limited to the Democrats, and you can even go back in history farther with Republicans and see the way in which you had long-serving Republican leaders have to deal with these challenges from the wings of the party, which, by the way, I think speaks interestingly enough to Mitch McConnell's skill as the leader of the Senate Republicans, that he's managed to stay in there given some similar dynamics on the Senate side with Republicans and the divisions within the party there.
I want to talk about President Trump and the 4th of July parade with the flyovers, the speech the president made last Thursday. There was heavy criticism going into that event. There hasn't been quite as much afterwards. But Lonnie, do you think that the event that the president held, that there was a lasting effect from that?
I don't think so. I think it served to cement, his supporters' disdain for people who oppose the president. And I think it also served to reinforce those who oppose the president's, their disdain for him. I mean, the reality is that, the president had a celebration for the 4th of July that was different from what previous presidents have done. There were a couple stories that cropped up around that. The event happened, I think, largely without too many noteworthy things happening, with the exception of the gaffe in his speech where he talked about taking over the airports during the Revolutionary War. But these kinds of things can happen, and I don't think it's going to have a lasting impact. I think if anything, it reflects, as I said, the division we have in our political culture, and people will see that celebration through the lens of how they see President Trump, and I think that's the where our politics is now.
Amanda Renteria, what do you think ultimately came of this event?
You know, I think we will look back on this as really a diversion to what really happens on 4th of July. I've spent many years going to the 4th of July. sense. And what it starts out with is actually a reading of the Declaration of Independence around this idea of those words and what were written. And what's interesting about it is it ends with, "But do not destroy the immortal emblem of humanity." And when you think about how far we are from that moment where you have tanks in the street and kids in cages, you begin to go, where are we? And what I think we will look back on this as is a different time and something that really did change from what we were about and the ideal and the idea of America.
Also wanted to talk about the Friday economic news where more than 200,000 jobs were added. It continues to show the economy overall doing very well. President Trump, though, has not been able to leverage the strong economy and shows, you know, his public opinion numbers staying fairly consistent. Amanda, your thoughts on those Friday job numbers and what would be typically a boon to an incumbent president?
I think it's the typical things for this administration are always going to be difficult because of how much attention he gets for all the other kind of distractions that he creates. And so one would argue that a good, strong economic forecast or number out there would always help. But in today's world, it's a little bit different. News is moving so fast. And in some ways, economic numbers are almost boring relative to some of the other things that he's been doing as part of the administration.
And it was funny, even with the tax cut, with the change in the withholding rules, the majority of Americans, even those who ended up paying less total tax, perceived that they did less well under the tax changes. Lonnie Chen, can the president in any way, capture this economy to his benefit?
Yeah, I think this is going to be the animating question of the election, quite frankly, Larry. There was a poll that came out over the weekend that the Washington Post did where, you know, essentially the conclusion is if the election is about President Trump, he's going to have a difficult time. If the election is about President Trump and how he's handled certain elements of policy, like the economy, most notably, you know, he's got a very good chance at winning re-election. And I think this speaks to the challenge that you have, because in a normal, you know, more normal pre-Trump administration, you would see the president out there talking about the economy and really trying to focus his attention on how do we capitalize on these economic numbers in that way. And I think this president, you know, tends not to be quite as focused on that message. And so it'll be interesting to see if he can win in spite of what should be, these really good numbers and a way of trumpeting them. But look, the economy, I think, is quite resilient, but it's tough to just look at 1 month's jobs numbers and say, look, this is what's happening with the economy. You have to look at a trend. And ultimately, what will be more important for President Trump is the trend going into the election next year. Is the economy improving or declining? President Obama took a rising economy to victory in 2012, even though the numbers objectively weren't great. The improvement, I think, was what mattered. And so we'll have to see where this goes next year. But I think the economy will be a big factor in this election one way or the other.
Amanda, quick thought from you about Iran with its announcement that it's enriching uranium past the level agreed to in the multinational nuclear agreement. What do you think of the implications for the U.S.?
You know, I whenever we start talking about any international conversations or what this country is doing, what this president is doing, I worry, because this is exactly the moments where we need our intelligence agency, we need our foreign military officials or our military officials to really step up and work with the president. This is usually when they are best at their work. This is usually when the country comes together to figure out what next steps are. My concern is that not everyone is on the same page. And I think we're going to see that again as we get to the end of this agreement. What do we do now?
All right. Amanda Renteria, always a pleasure. Thank you for being with us. President,
thank you for having me on.
Emerge America, which works to identify and train Democratic women for political office. She was national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. Also, for a number of years, was a senatorial staffer. Lonnie Chen, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, also advised the Rubio 2016 and Romney 2012 campaigns. Coming up, the very latest from Ridgecrest. We'll talk about the powerful earthquakes and how the towns of Ridgecrest and Trona are trying to come back. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies.